everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. And today we're devoting the entire show to the 2018 Man Booker Prize. Chair of Judges Anthony Appiah will reveal this year's shortlist and how it was arrived at.
It's always difficult, I think, because there's usually an awful lot of very good books, and this year is absolutely no exception.
Essie Adujan introduces us to the phenomenal story of Washington Black.
It's really through his taking Wash out of his situation in the fields that Washington comes to have a greater sense of himself as a fully realized human being.
Richard Powers waxes lyrical about trees.
Part of the book is to open the eyes of readers, as my character's eyes are open, to the majesty and the astonishment and the richness and complexity of the neighbors.
And we hear from both the youngest author ever to have been shortlisted and the oldest living author to have received the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. That's all coming up in today's Read On. First awarded in 1969, the Man Booker is recognised as the leading prize for literary fiction written in the English language. It's open to writers of any nationality, for novels written in English and published in the UK. The list of former winners includes many of the leading writers of the last five decades, from Iris Murdoch to Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan to Hilary Mantel. This year's shortlist of six novels was announced by the Chair of Judges Kwame Anthony Appiah on a blustery evening in the grounds of the Serpentine Gallery in London's Hyde Park, and I caught up with him moments before he went on stage. Anthony, welcome to Read On.
I'm very glad to be with you.
So, was it a difficult process this year, judging to choose the final six for the shortlist?
It's always difficult, I think, because there's usually an awful lot of very good books, and this year is absolutely no exception. And getting down to 13 was difficult to make the long list, and really hard getting from 13 to 6, because I think all the 13 on the long list were terrific. But it's a very congenial group of people. We work well together. We've been reading together now for, you know, since early in the year, meeting once a month, and so guided by each other, really, we came to a final six, which represent the judgment, the collective judgment of us all. So none of us would have chosen exactly the six if you just left it to us on our own. So it's definitely it's the jury's list. And we're all very happy with it. We all like every book on it. We like a lot of books that aren't on it too.
Were there any that all the judges chose? Obviously, you can't tell me which, but or were there a wide cross-section of books that everybody had as a favourite?
That sort of isn't how the conversations go, so you don't say, this is my book and I'm going to, stand behind it until you trample me into the ground. So I don't think of any of the books on the final list, really, as belonging to anybody in particular on the group. I suppose if you ask them, each of the judges might be able to say that they liked some more than others now. But honestly, we were talking to each other this morning, and we all agree that we don't know who's going to win. I mean, we and not just because we can't predict what the other people will do. We haven't, any of us, made up our minds ourselves. These books survive an amazing test, which is that we read them once. If they get onto the long list, we read them again. And if they get on the shortlist, we read them again. Not many novels survive being reread with careful attention three times in a row. Many people read a novel for a second time, but they don't usually do it within 6 months or a month. So we learned a lot on the second reading, and I'm sure we'll learn more on the third reading.
Many of our listeners have to access their books as audiobooks. Were any of the judges tempted to listen to the books as audiobooks rather than read them in print?
I don't think anybody did that. Nobody mentioned doing that. I certainly read them all in print. I should say that on the long list was at least one book that would be difficult for someone who was blind or visually impaired, because it was mostly images. It was a graphic novel. And that one of the novels on the short list, The Long Take, has photographs mostly of Los Angeles in the early 20th century which are quite an important part of the book, and those obviously will be difficult for visually impaired people, but it's a poem, so there's lots and lots of words in it too. So actually the one that would have been hardest for your listeners would have been the graphic novel, just because it's mostly images. There's some words in it. But otherwise, I think I can say that at least one of the novels on the shortlist is a novel that I would like to hear myself, because it's in the voice of a character whose voice is very important to the novel. And in a way, at least one of the novels, I think, will work at least as well, if not better, as an audiobook, because it's very, because the voice of the narrator is so important to what the book is about. So there may be on the final six, there may be at least one that blind and visually impaired people will actually appreciate more than sighted people.
Well, we are very much looking forward to listening to the shortlist and our Braille readers to reading them in Braille, which is a fantastic thing that the Booker Foundation does for us. And Anthony, thank you very much for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, featuring the 2018 Man Booker Prize. Before we hear from some of the authors on this year's shortlist, thanks to a long-standing arrangement with RNIB, the Booker Prize Foundation again funded the production of Braille, giant print and talking book versions of all the books on the shortlist, ensuring that tens of thousands of RNIB library members could join in the discussion. Eve Smith is the secretary of the Booker Foundation, and she too was at the shortlist party. I asked her to explain her role a little further.
It's the person who is responsible for all the things that actually aren't to do with the judges and the books. It's making sure the prize works and that our relationship with the RNIB works and all of the outreach work that we do.
And you make it possible for blind and partially sighted readers to have access to all the books on the shortlist every year, and have done for the last 15 years. So a huge thank you to you, and the books just get better and better, don't they?
Well, I think what happens is that they become more and more interesting in terms of what they're trying to do, and it's very challenging, I suspect, for the formats to reflect that. And that's what's so exciting about working with the RNIB, because you know through the different formats that they are using for converting, you know, the books for the visually impaired. It means that you can get a taste of what's really going on in contemporary literature. And you say they get better and better, they get more and more interesting, and from that point of view it gets better and better.
This year, obviously, on the long list there was a book, Sabrina, which was a graphic novel, which was going to present a few problems for turning into an audiobook, but actually it's rather nice to see that one of the books that has made the shortlist this year is a book that's got photographs which are going to be described to visually impaired readers on the talking book.
Well, that's interesting, because I can see the challenges in that book, because it's not just the photographs, the font changes during the course of the book, and it varies between verse and dialogue. So there are all sorts of interesting things that are going on that are very much geared to the visual. But I think it is something that will, with the sort of sophistication which the RNIB approach to the formats brings, will actually translate very well to the formats that are accessible. So it will be interesting to get people's feedback on whether that works or not.
I hope you enjoy working with the RNIB Talking Book team, because they are the experts as far as making books accessible, and I think they rather relish the fact that they are pushing back the boundaries of what is possible in this day and age.
Yes, and I mean, which sort of meshes with what the prize is doing, because, you know, what is a novel, what is long form fiction, all of those things are sort of coming into sort of the commentary on what's happening in literature now. And so as well as having that direct effect on how you transpose those into formats that are for the visually impaired, you've also got the very real challenges of the difference between looking at something and hearing it or understanding it. And I think we're very excited to be working in that field, to be working with you.
Well, Eve, thank you so much for making so many books so accessible to blind and partially sighted readers.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's Man Booker Prize special, Essie Adujan will introduce us to Washington Black, and we'll hear from the youngest person ever to be shortlisted for this most prestigious of literary awards. But first, Richard Powers is an award-winning American author whose works explore the effects of modern science and technology. He describes his latest novel, The Overstory, as being all about trees, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
If someone who hasn't read it yet, give us an overview of The Overstory.
It's a book about trees and people and the deep, deep connections between them. I set in motion the lives of nine characters who come from very different backgrounds and who have very different temperaments and personal histories, but all of whom are in some way ambushed by trees. And in particular, many of them come together to take part in what we in North America call the Timber Wars, as the activity, the environmental activism in the late 90s and early 2000s to try to prevent the cutting of the last few remnants of old-growth forest in North America.
That's one thing we don't get if we consume the audio version, is the cover of the book. I know there are different covers in different regions, but the one I'm looking at is that a painting of those forests of old?
So you must be looking at the North American cover, which is a painting by Albert Bierstadt, who was a great pioneer for landscape painting in the western part of the United States in the 19th century. And what we've done is manipulate that picture to be reminiscent of tree rings. But there's something striking in the image that I truly love. This is an image of the big trees, sequoias, in California that Bierstadt was among the first Europeans to see in the middle part of the 19th century. What I love about the picture is you can be looking at this glorious forest and this wonderful brown and green tonal register and only belatedly realize that there are two tiny human figures in the center of the painting on horseback. And then you notice that this enormous sequoia tree that's lying dead on its side on the forest floor towers above even these men on horseback, that the width of the tree is so enormous that it rises above their head even in death.
I remember seeing a postcard years ago of a car driving through a tunnel that had been carved in the root of a tree.
Yeah, and depending on the particular tree, they actually did cut tunnels in a few of these giant sequoias. Your particular tree may or may not last because for some reason, if you take a 3,000-year-old tree and cut the middle out of it, it doesn't last a very long time afterwards. There's some kind of metaphor for human indifference or interference in those fables. But there are two species of gigantic tree that still exist in California, the sequoia and the coastal redwood. These are ancient, venerable trees. It's not unusual among the larger trees that they get to, say, even 10 meters in width and 100 meters tall. And, of course, 1,500 years or older, the sequoias can actually be greater than 3,000 years. So these are just stupendous and spectacular trees. And my characters, as was I when I discovered this, are just completely that human beings are still cutting them down, even though 98% of the old growth forest and a good 95% of the redwood forest did fall under the axe after the arrival of the Europeans.
As writing the book made you look at the wooden objects in your life in a different way?
It absolutely has. 6 years ago, when I started the book, I was pretty much oblivious to trees. I took them for granted. I might appreciate them as aesthetic objects or be grateful for their shade on a hot day. But I wasn't one who could tell the difference between an elm tree and an ash tree. And writing this story and immersing myself in the lives of trees and the agency of trees and the incredibly rich, complicated behavior and society of trees over 6 years has made me see not just living trees in a different way in the forest as a different kind of entity than I realized it was, but as you say, all the human artifacts that we make that derive from trees with a new kind of reverence and awe. And it's not an exaggeration, as one of my characters says, when you begin to list the amount of derivatives and artifacts and objects that we still make from, you know, either wood directly or from cellulose and lignin, you know, the components of trees, to say, it's not an exaggeration to say that we're still living in the age of wood.
You say in the book that the trees live a quiet existence, but it's a quiet existence that's really hiding an industry of keeping themselves alive.
Yes. You know, many of the forests in Britain and in Europe and now in North America have been converted to agricultural purposes, to forestry, to what amounts to tree farms or tree plantations. And in part, we've perhaps justified the use of these creatures as resources because we haven't fully understood just how complicated trees are, how social they are, and how rich a forest ecosystem can be. And we have perhaps been mistaken in believing that trees will always grow back and that no matter how we treat them, they will return. And it was sobering for me to realize as I wrote the book that, in fact, no human being has ever seen an old-growth forest, a rich, complicated, interconnected ecosystem of the kind that exists when a forest is allowed to reach full maturity over the course of millennia. No one has ever seen a clear-cut come back to that same degree of richness. So part of the book is to open the eyes of readers, as my characters' eyes are opened, to the majesty and the astonishment and the richness and complexity of the neighbors, of the creatures that have made our civilization possible.
And the fact that in the book and in research I've read it elsewhere, the trees actually communicate to each other, and it's not just elm to elm, they communicate across species as well.
Truly remarkable, and this is research that's been unfolding for a few decades now, and it's just starting to percolate into the public imagination and realization. Not only do trees signal each other over the air with chemical semaphores, chemical messages that alert, say, distant trees to an invasion, either of insects or other herbivores, but they are, as you say, connected underground by fungal filaments that will share resources and food and medicines, not just between trees of the same species, but trees of different species. And that a big, mature Douglas fir, for instance, that reaches up into the sun, can actually be sending sugars through these fungal intermediaries to, say, a rather small birch that's been stunted for many decades because it's, you know, it's in a dark, heavily shaded understory. And this notion that, you know, our understanding as nature primarily a competitive phenomenon. Red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson says, has to be revised, and that we have to realize that for every act of competition, that there are many, many acts of cooperation going on in a forest. It's this notion that lies at the heart of a book that's essentially a plea for human beings to realize that they, too, are not exceptional and are not separate creatures, but are richly connected and imbricated and reciprocally beholden to all kinds of other living things.
There's a character in the book with a sensory disability. It's hearing, it's not sight loss, but that initial isolation that she feels will resonate with a lot of our listeners.
Yes. This is a character named Patricia, and she has a hearing impediment when she's young, and consequently her speech is not particularly easy to understand, and her schoolmates tease her mercilessly and isolate her, and she's a bit bewildered by humans because of this this barrier between her and her peers. It's her father who takes her under his wing and teaches her about the richness of the non-human world, and she finds some consolation in having the society of green things open to her, where the society of human beings has remained a kind of tough mystery for her to crack. She tells her father one day that she's astonished that her schoolmates can't tell the difference between one kind of tree and another, and how can that possibly be when they're surrounded by these rich and marvelous things? And her father says, you know, that's Adam's curse. It's a sad thing, but we human beings tend to struggle to identify with or understand anything that doesn't look and feel and behave just like us.
Now, we heard at the beginning Suzanne Torin reading from the audio version, and I think she's got the perfect voice for it. Have you listened to the audio version?
You know, it's very interesting. When the audiobook producers first contacted me, they gave me the choice of three male readers, and they asked me which one I would prefer to perform the book. And I listened to them, and they were all very good. But in the back of my head, I thought, you know, the female characters in my group of nine are actually in the majority and probably the most important characters. And wouldn't it be lovely to have a female narrator? And I wrote to them, and they got very enthusiastic about this idea. And they sent me three samples of three different female voice actors, all of whom were very good. I picked Suzanne Toland because of an intelligence, a nuance, a warmth, and a humaneness to her voice. And I was delighted in her performance that she attempts to render each of these characters with their own vocal signatures and to inhabit almost like a single person dramatic play, all of these different performers, protagonists, both male and female.
Do you think listening to the audiobook changes the reading experience?
Yes, I do. I do think I'm an avid listener to audiobooks. I do think that sometimes, you know, you are at the mercy of the performer in the way that you are with a musical concert, that if the performer doesn't have an affinity for the prose or the piece, it can be an impediment between you and a full immersion. But when the performer is good, as Suzanne Toland is, there's an enhancement. You can actually get more out of the words on the page because someone who has spent a lot of time and thought deeply about the words is bringing you to places and nuances and depth inside the prose that might not have occurred to you.
All books on the Booker shortlist are available in audio and in braille and in giant print for blind and partially sighted readers. Is that an important thing to you?
Absolutely. Just as my book deals with people who, for one reason or another, are prevented from experiencing the world in the way that others of us take for granted. I am deeply grateful for any medium that allows readers and our audience to come to my words in a way that opens to them. So much of the book is about taking taking seriously this notion of the broadness and the diversity and the complexity and the difference behind human experience, and to create these channels of connection and empathy. And it's so important to me to know that readers from all kinds of walks of life and all kinds of experiences have a chance to engage this book and to come to it on their terms.
Have you heard about that? A park, I think it was in Australia, where every tree was given an identification number and an email address. The email was to report damage, but people started writing little emails to the trees. Did you hear that story?
Yeah, I did, and I was so delighted by it. The outpouring. I mean, people do feel an intense connection with these other creatures that operate on such different time frames and on such different physical scales and with such different behavior. There is something that really awakens our imagination and our curiosity and our gratitude to not be alone here on this world when that moment happens and we begin to see the agency and the personality of a tree and the fact that so many people, you know, responded directly to the tree and simply wanted to say things from their heart about how much the trees have meant to them. That was very moving to me.
Richard Powers, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Richard Powers. If you'd like to leaf through The Overstory, it's available in Braille, giant print, and as talking book number 24562.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's Bokingtuk. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake, and if...
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, devoted to the 2018 Man Booker Prize, whose entire shortlist is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation. Now, before we hear the books of Penelope Lively's life, it's time to hear from another of this year's shortlisted authors. Essie Adujan is a Canadian author whose works reflect her own global perspective. Her second novel, Half Blood Blues, was shortlisted for the 2011 Man Booker Prize and features a mixed-race jazz musician abducted in Nazi Germany. Her latest novel, Washington Black, is another historical novel that ranges across continents. And it's inspired by a true story, as I found out when I spoke to her via Skype from her home in British Columbia. Essie Adujan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
For readers who haven't yet read Washington Black, could you give us a little bit of background to the story?
So Washington Black is a novel set in the 1830s, and it's about an 11-year-old field slave called Washington Black, who was born on a plantation in the Caribbean, and he's known no other life. It's he has been a slave his entire life. He has rarely known a kindness from anyone, and so he's quite shocked to find himself taken to live in the quarters of his new master's brother, who's a man called Christopher or Titch Wilde. Washington is horrified by the prospect of going to live with this man, but he soon finds that Titch is completely different from every other white man that he's ever known. Titch is a gentleman scientist, so he's a naturalist, he's an inventor, he's an illustrator, but he's also an abolitionist. And it's really through his taking Wash out of his situation in the fields that Washington comes to have a greater sense of himself as a fully realized human being. And he understands that he too has gifts to offer the world.
And you were inspired to write the story by a real life story. I believe it's based in part on the longest running legal case in British history.
Yeah, so it's the Tichborne claimant trials. They started in the 1860s and ran all throughout then and all throughout the 1870s, and were indeed the longest running series of criminal trials in the British courts until like the 1980s. And essentially what happened was the scion of a very wealthy family from the south of England was shipwrecked at sea. He was a bit of a dandy and had been making a pleasure tour and ended up being shipwrecked off the I think it was Argentina. But in any case, he had a very, very doting mother, and she just was so devastated and refused to believe that he had died. It just didn't seem natural to her. So she consulted a clairvoyant who assured her that her son, whose name was Roger Tichborne, was alive and well and living his life in a distant country. So what she did was put notices in newspapers and get a response back from a place called Wagga. Essentially, the gist of what the note was mother, my life is a butcher in a small Australian town, but I'm ready to come back now and take up my mantle, the head of the estates, and assume my inheritance. And she was utterly delighted, but she was utterly convinced that it was him. But just in case it wasn't, she thought that she would dispatch somebody to go out and make the identification. And just by chance, one of the household servants, who'd worked at the Tichborne estate for 40 years, he had retired recently to Sydney, Australia, so it was very convenient for her to consult him and ask him to go see if it was indeed Roger living in Wagga. And this man's name was Andrew Bogle. And he was an ex-slave who had been stolen off of a plantation in the Caribbean by Sir Edward Tichborne, a member of the Tichborne household, who had been doing a bit of work, I guess, at a friend's plantation and had seen this young man and decided to take him away and steal him away. And Bogle lived out most of his life in England as a servant for the family and and had a whole new life. And so when I was approaching the claimant trials, I really wanted to depict them through, you know, through Bogle's eyes. And but as I sat down to write them, I realized that I was kind of less interested in all of the many details of the trial that just went on for decades. And I was much more interested in the psychology of somebody like Bogle, who had been, you know, born and raised in very brutal circumstances and would have felt like everything in his life was preordained and that he would likely die on the plantation. So to be removed from that very suddenly and taken to a place that was so radically different from everything he had known, you know, I was interested in how that would manifest itself, you know, in his psyche and what that would do to him and what kind of trauma he was still carrying with him forward into these, you know, these new years of his life.
And like your previous two novels, it's very much a book about aftermath, about rebuilding one's life after terrible events and trying to find happiness and fulfillment in a world that is set against you.
Exactly. And trying to kind of reestablish, I guess, your own identity, just trying to find your foothold in the world and to create. Really, Washington has to recreate his sense of self, which has been so, you know, trampled upon for his early years. He really has to figure out who he is as a person and, you know, accept that he too has rights in the world. He really has to develop a sense of agency and taking control of his life and accepting that certain things are within his grasp to change, but then there are things that will forever lay outside of his grasp, and that being physically free is, you know, his physical freedom maybe doesn't open him up to every other type of freedom that he imagined that it would.
And that experiment that Washington constructs with his making of his own new life is mirrored in the scientific experiments that are going on around him, initially with his master Titch, who is fascinated by flight, and then with an exploration of marine biology. You're clearly also fascinated by early scientific discovery during the 19th century.
Yes, very. It was something where I discovered I was fascinated by it almost by accident. It was, you know, I was feeling my way through the novel, trying to really get a sense of Washington's character, what his interests would be, what he would be leaning towards. And then I just started reading about, I guess, historical science and naturalism and the first environmentalists and discovering how they went about classifying specimens. And I realized I had a very deep interest in this, and it really took over the second half of the novel, and I was it was a real pleasure to get to write about that.
That pleasure really comes through, and whilst you dig deep into, well, both the early flight and marine biology, you never layer it on in trowelfuls. Where do you stop with research and start putting your fingers through the keyboard?
Yeah, I'm somebody who I start every book with research, you know, because you need something to help you enter the text. And because I tend to write historical novels, it does require some background in certain things. So for Washington Black, that was reading about plantation life as it manifested itself specifically in the Caribbean, and even more specifically in Barbados. So reading deeply about that, it wasn't so much delving into the science at the very outset, but I also research as I'm writing, and this is something that helps keep my mind in the book and helps keep me interested, because I'm continually discovering new facts and able to put them into the book, or, you know, to go back and use them when I'm revising. So I'm researching from before I write until probably, you know, just before I end the book, and it's just been my process, and it's been very helpful.
It's quite a political book, and I know that you describe yourself as a black writer who needs to confront the world as a black person, but you managed to keep bitterness from the anger that you feel at what Washington undergoes and what your other protagonists have undergone. How do you do that? Because some pretty awful things happen in all three of your books, actually.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that the characters do feel, you know, a deep bitterness over the injustices that have been perpetrated upon them. But, you know, bitterness is one of the stages, one of the many stages of grief that people go through after they've been through something traumatic. So I think it's, I don't know about bitterness, but certainly a kind of resignation does permeate the books. It's definitely there, and the anger. But these are novels about people who are confronting their pasts, but also trying to construct their futures and look towards, you know, what life could be in the coming years. And so perhaps that's what's maybe taking the edge off a bit.
I did wonder also whether the fact that science is there to be destructively tested, science only moves forward once you've disproved something, also shows a hope that any wrong belief will eventually be proved wrong and something better will come from it.
Yeah, I love that reading of it. I think that's great. But, and I think that's true in some cases, that we have, you know, science is the discarding of one theory for another. It's working through things. And maybe sometimes, though, those off theories don't get discarded. And that's something that we have to definitely to look at and to try and be on guard about. But yeah, there is a feeling that at some point, something that seems, you know, like it's wrong, it will eventually be discounted. That's the hope.
I know that many people with sight loss would love to have as strong a champion for our marginalised community as you provide. Do you know of any really strong blind writers, either over in Canada or that you've met in your travels?
I know of one, and he's a poet. I believe he did a memoir about his blindness. I think his name is Ryan Knighton. He did a memoir about going blind. He's very slowly going blind, but he's very young. And it started when he was a very young man, I believe in his 20s. And, you know, that book was, you know, extremely eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people who don't really understand what it's like. So yeah, that was a very important book that came out a few years ago here.
Well, hopefully, like you, he will inspire others to take up their pen and write. You must be delighted that your books have been made accessible to people who are print disabled. Do you take an interest in the audiobook narrators who are chosen?
You know, until I did Washington Black, I was never really consulted about the actors and the whole process. But with this last book, it was very interesting. I was let into the room, so to speak. So I you know, spoke with the actor and the producer, and the actor tried out different voices to, you know, we were really trying to get the right accent. And it was a wonderful process. And I think Dion Graham did a brilliant job at the audiobook. It's a miracle. He just sounds exactly right.
And you, of course, are married to another author, aren't you? Does that create a little bit of competition in the house?
You know, it's been good. I'm married to the poet and novelist Stephen Price. He's an amazing writer. He's got such discipline that he really, you know, he puts me to shame, and he's a real example for me. But it's been really great in that he and I edit each other's work. And so he's been through most drafts of my novels. I think he gets a bit tired near the end, but you know, he'll go through them quite rigorously. And I can honestly say that the books, you know, they wouldn't look as they do without his hand on them. So I'm really appreciative and grateful to live with another writer.
So this is the second time that you've been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Did you get the same frisson of excitement when you got the result?
I did, absolutely. It's, I mean, it's quite incredible. I would never have thought, you know, that this could happen twice and for a follow-up book. And it's just, it's so exciting. I'm so excited and thrilled and honored. And yeah, it's always exciting. I don't know. I think you'd have to be pretty jaded not to be excited.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Essie Adudjian, and I look forward to reading plenty more of your fine novels in the future.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks to Essie Adudjian. Washington Black is available from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB24614. It's narrated by James Good. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or phone the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Now, before we hear from the oldest living winner of the Man Booker Prize, at 27, Daisy Johnson this year became the youngest person ever to be shortlisted for the award. At the party in the Serpentine Gallery, she told me more about her debut novel, Everything Under. Daisy Johnson, congratulations on Everything Under being shortlisted for the 2018 Man Booker Prize. You must be delighted.
I'm completely speechless. People keep asking me how I am and I can't quite find the words. But yeah, I'm very, very happy.
Are you a keen reader of the shortlisted Man Booker Prize entries every year? Did you ever dream that this might happen?
Yeah, I read a lot of them. I think it's a really good way to, you know which books are doing really, really well, find really interesting, innovative reads. I never dreamed this would happen. It was not even in my, you know, realm of consideration.
Now, Everything Under is currently being made into a talking book and Braille copies so that RNIB members can read it. Could you just give us a very brief synopsis?
It's a book about a young woman who has lived for a very long time on her own, and she has memories of her mother who she grew up with, and she lived with her on a canal boat. And it's a book about her trying to find her mother, and as she does so, remember what happened when she was a child.
And I hear that there's something lurking in the canal waters as well.
Yes, there is also something called a bonac, which lives in the water and begins to haunt the people who live on the river.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Yeah, I love audiobooks, actually. I listen to them while I run and, you know, on long car journeys. I really, really enjoy them, yeah.
So you must be delighted that readers who are print disabled are going to be able to read your book.
So delighted, really, really happy. Yeah, I'm excited to hear it.
Well, I'll let you get back to the party. I wish you the very best of luck, and I hope that we can get you into the studio to talk further about Everything Under.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
Daisy Johnson, thank you for being a guest on Connect Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Everything Under by Daisy Johnson is, of course, available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Dame Penelope Lively won the Booker Prize in 1984 for her novel Moon Tiger. It's a haunting tale of loss, loneliness, and secret desire, with a complex, compelling, and unforgettable protagonist. And it was one of the five novels shortlisted for the Golden Man Booker Prize earlier this year, celebrating the best of the prize's 50-year history. Dame Penelope is the oldest surviving winner of the Man Booker Prize, and Moon Tiger is a novel that I love. So I was keen to explore the books of her life. So, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you want to become an author?
Well, I wouldn't say that there was specifically. I didn't go to school until I was 12. In my childhood years in Egypt, I was educated at home in a very sort of haphazard way, but that was based entirely upon reading. So I read a huge amount as a child, although in a restricted way, because we didn't have a library. So it was only the sort of the books that we had, as it were. But I read and read, and that was a habit that continued. So what I would say in answer to that mainly is that I became a writer out of obsessive reading, you know, years and years of obsessive reading. But I think a very central book of my childhood was Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Mine was probably the last generation where all children read it fairly automatically, and not all may have responded to it, but I did. I always loved it, was fascinated by the play with language, by the fantasy element, by everything. And of course, it's an amazing book at every level. I've gone on reading it ever since. So I would put that as a very seminal book of my childhood, yes.
For a minute or two, she stood looking at the house and wondering what to do next, when suddenly a footman in livery came running out of the wood. She considered him to be a footman because he was in livery. Otherwise, judging by his face only, she would have called him a fish. And rapped loudly at the door with his knuckles. It was opened by another footman in livery, with a round face and large eyes like a frog. And both footmen, Alice noticed, had powdered hair that curled all over their heads. She felt very curious to know what it was all about, and crept a little way out of the wood to listen. The fish footman began by producing from under his arm a great letter, nearly as large as himself. And this he handed over to the other, saying in a solemn tone, "For the Duchess, an invitation from the Queen to play croquet." The frog footman repeated in the same solemn tone, only changing the order of the words a little. "From the Queen, an invitation for the Duchess to play croquet." Then they both bowed low, and their curls got entangled together. Alice laughed so much at this that she had to run back into the wood for fear of their hearing her. And when next she peeped out, the fish footman was gone, and the other was sitting on the ground near the door, staring stupidly up into the sky.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB13087, narrated by Robin Holmes. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, the trouble is there are so many. If I started, we'd be here all afternoon and into the evening. So actually what I'd do instead, I'd say that as a novelist, there are actually three novels that I go back to when I want to remind myself of what the novel can do, how amazing and flexible the novel is. One of them is William Golding's The Inheritors, which is his one set in Neanderthal times, and it's quite remarkable. It's also the saddest book I know. Another is Henry James' What Maisie Knew, where the sort of dire things that are going on in a family are shown through the eyes of a 7-year-old child, and so that you look over the child's shoulder, as it were, and see the chicanery and bad behaviour of the adults of which she is not aware. It's an extraordinarily clever, dexterous piece of writing. And the last would be Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, which again is a novel that sort of trips you up all the way, because there are delicate shifts of information that make you realise that what you had been thinking is quite wrong, that actually things are quite different. So for a novelist, these are the novels that show me how it can be done in absolutely masterly hands.
You may well ask why I write, and yet my reasons are quite many. For it is not unusual in human beings who have witnessed the sack of a city or the falling to pieces of a people to desire to set down what they have witnessed for the benefit of unknown heirs or of generations infinitely remote. Or, if you please, just to get the sight out of their heads. Someone has said that the death of a mouse from cancer is the whole sack of Rome by the Goths. And I swear to you that the breaking up of our little four-square coterie was such another unthinkable event. Supposing that you should come upon us sitting together at one of the little tables in front of the clubhouse, let us say at Homburg, taking tea of an afternoon and watching the miniature golf, you would have said that, as human affairs go, we were an extraordinarily safe castle. We were, if you will, one of those tall ships with the white sails upon a blue sea, one of those things that seemed the proudest and the safest of all the beautiful and safe things that God has permitted the mind of men to frame. Where better could one take refuge? Where better?
The Good Soldier, written by Ford Madox Ford and narrated by Peter Wickham, is TB16485. It's also available in Braille. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
There's a wonderful, very short, and now having said that I'm not that keen on historical novels, it's a historical novel. It's by Caris Davis and it's called West. It's very brief. It's very brilliant. It's about a man in the American West who is convinced that somewhere in the hinterland that people have not yet penetrated, there are still mammoths. And he goes off on this search for mammoths, but it's also about what happens to his child who he leaves at home. And it's quite remarkable because it's a historical novel where absolutely none of the underpinning shows. I mean, I know as a novelist that a great deal of research must have gone into this. You would be totally unaware of this. It's as though it just lifted, fully made from its time and its place. It's brilliant. West by Caris Davis.
West by Caris Davis is available commercially in print and ebook formats wherever you buy your books. Dame Penelope Lively, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you, I've enjoyed it.
Don't forget, you too can share the books of your life by emailing us via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for in this week's Man Booker Prize special edition of Read On. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.